The following Dharma discourse was given by Jeffrey Shugen Arnold at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugen Roshi is the head of the Mountains and Rivers Order and abbot of the monastery. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or find out more about our various programs, visit us online at zmm.org. Thank you for listening.
So I had prepared a talk for this morning, but with the power outage and the fact that we're not live streaming, I decided to do something else. I thought I would talk a little bit about the monastic life. It's rare that we have an opportunity where we're just the monastics and the residents. Even during the whole of the pandemic, we've almost always been live streaming. And so I am inspired to say a few words. In the Transmission of Light, there's a story of Punyamitra. And when he met his teacher, Vasishtha, his teacher asked him, why do you want to leave home? And home leaving in Buddhism means to leave and home and be ordained, to leave the one's worldly life, one's family, connections, wealth, and so on. Punyamitra said, if I leave home, it's not for anything else. And Vasishtha said, not for what? And Punyamitra said, not for anything mundane. And Vasishtha said, then for what? And Punyamitra said, to do Buddha work. When I was going to college, the first couple of years, my parents couldn't help me financially, so I was taking small loans and working, paying my own way, going to schools where I didn't incur too much debt because I was very debt averse. And in my third year, my grandparents passed away in an accident, and my family, my father, inherited some money, and so they were able to help me go to school. And I remember it took a while to sort of recalibrate and to think that I was able to go to school, and that's all I needed to do was to apply myself to my studies. And I felt like I had died and gone to heaven. I felt so fortunate, unexpectedly fortunate, to be able to just singularly devote myself to my studies. When I first came here, I was not seeking the monastic life. I was not seeking community life. I was not even seeking a teacher. I was trying to find a way to continue to move forward in my practice, which at that point meant my meditation, because I knew that I had reached the end of what I could do on my own. I don't know how I knew that, but I just felt like I had become stale, stagnant, that I had guided myself as far as I could. And coming here and meeting Dada Roshi and then beginning to be more active in training at a time where there were no ordained monastics. There were two novices, Kyoto and Myotai, a postulant, Koen. But slowly the idea began to plant its seed within me. And as that grew, all of my well-laid plans and ideas about what my life was going to be were kind of coming apart. They were good plans, and it would have been a good life for somebody, but not for me. That's what I was coming to see. And I remember right where I was coming home from classes, and suddenly I knew that this was what I wanted my life to be. And there was that element of the possibility unexpected, never thought before in my life, of being able to devote myself completely to the Dharma. I'd never thought about that as a possibility or even thought of wanting that, because it wasn't a possibility. It wasn't something I saw any example of. And if I had, I'd or have known any place where it was happening. And then there it was. Here it was. And so most of you are not monastics. I understand that. And yet, I think that there's much in the monastic life that everyone can learn from, in the same way that monastics have so much to learn from what we call lay life. And monasticism is in a kind of an interesting place, which may mean that Buddhism is kind of in an interesting place, because throughout all of its history, the places, the people, the sort of the ways in which the inner light, the inner workings, the inner guts of Buddha Dharma have been practiced and developed and evolved and passed down has been within the monasteries. And lay practitioners always had a very important role. But traditionally, it wasn't so much a practice role, not in the way that we practice. And that was how it has come down to us. And so now that's changed tremendously. There are essentially three monasteries in the United States, in the whole country, for certainly within our tradition, the Soto tradition. And perhaps an increasing sense that monasticism is not important, not necessary, may even be irrelevant. As one teacher I know in a monastery says that they feel sometimes that monasticism is under siege. And so we'll see how that all works out. The Buddha made it clear that monastic or lay, that every human being has Buddha nature. And every human being, fundamentally because of that, has the potential to realize enlightenment. Practically speaking, there has to be a reasonable amount of physical and mental, psychological well-being. In other words, there may be some states of being that make practice and the things that practice requires not practical or tenable in this lifetime. And for lay life, he said that because a lay student has everything that a monastic has and a different life, and that life normally is filled with work and home and possessions and relationships and family and community, and that all of those require an ongoing and tremendous outflow of energies and attention and care and a devotion of those energies to those very things. Think of having a child and how the child coming into this world establishes an imperative. That's why monastics in our tradition, in our Sangha, while being allowed to have relationships, are asked not to have children. Kyodo, who was a novice when I first came, was asking to be ordained, but Dada wouldn't ordain her until her son, Jori, who was living here at the time, was independent, no longer needed her. And so that child establishes an imperative that supersedes the needs, in a sense, of the parent, the individual needs, other than those needs that help to support and nurture and grow that child well. And so then the needs and the the desires of the parent then have to be integrated into. And I'm speaking, in a sense, at a distance, because I've never had a child, so you parents may disagree with me and have every reason to. And so all of those things that a person has in their life that they need and want in their life to have their life be rich and full and stable and solvent and self-supporting have their own imperatives, have their own requirements, have their own demands for attention and energy and time. And that attention means physical energy. It means mental energy. It means focusing, bringing attention to, and all of the life forces that a person has gets poured into those various relationships, as it must be. And so the Buddha said, therein lies the challenge, because all of those become, in a sense, have the potential to take the person out in their mind. And so we teach, and our lay students in our Sangha are very dedicated to trying to really integrate the Dharma in their lives in all of those relationships, and to be seeing the Dharma and their practice and their meditation and their compassion all flowing into those various relationships, which is an incredible thing and a very powerful thing and a great challenge. I mean, if we think about how just sitting quietly in a meditation hall and a movement, a word by the monitor, or a breeze passes by, or somebody coughs, or you see the light shifting in front of you, or there's just a very slight movement inside of you, and how quickly the mind moves, how quickly we get drawn by movement. And so then to think of those various aspects of a person's life as all forms of movement, right, that are not just calling our attention outward, but are in movement, in motion, or in flux in every moment. And how easy it then would be to become distracted, in a sense, to become either just literally distracted in terms of just not mindful, but also in a subtler way, distracted in the sense of just having no relation, having no connection, this not being Buddha work, this just being mundane. And that when we sit, or when we do liturgy, or when we study, then we're turning back towards the Dharma. And that's the challenge that, in particular, lay students have to work with, is trying to dissolve that internal sense of duality, of boundary. And so then the monastic enters in our world, in our way, enters into a life in which all of those are still present, relationships with people, relationships with work, with, in a sense, having stability, financial stability, keeping our house in order, right? Doing many of the things that lay practitioners do. We have to literally take care of our house. We have to prepare meals. We have to clean up after those meals. We have to sweep floors and clean bathrooms. We have to engage in activities that will provide us with the means by which we can be here. In other words, we have to generate an income. And for the monastic, all of that is happening physically in one place. The objects that we are surrounded with are, in a sense, ordinary objects, people and dishes and brooms and so on. But they are embedded within this place that has been designated, sanctified, you might say, opened as a Dharma hall, as a mountain light of practice, study, and realization of the way. And not only is that here, but it's its sole purpose for being here. It's the only reason it's here. It's the only reason we are here. It's the only reason the monastic is here. And so there's a singularity of purpose, of intention, of world, such that one's physical being, one's physical objects, the activities that we engage in, the stuff of our lives, are all brought into one place, one room. And that room is designated as a place of awakening, as a place of meditation, as a place of cultivating compassion, as a place of practicing and fulfilling our bodhisattva vow. And just as any practitioner anywhere will, we will forget. So monastics will forget. And particularly as time goes on and all of this becomes more and more ordinary, it becomes, in a sense, easier to forget. But then as our practice is developing, at the same time, it becomes harder to forget because that division is dissolving, that sense of what is worldly or mundane and what is sacred, what is Buddha Dharma and what is not Buddha Dharma, what is practice and what is not practice, must be dissolving. That is the challenge, the, in a sense, the mandate that is given to the monastic. That is the vow that the monastic has made within themselves, to live a unified life, an undivided life. And so the Buddha treasure, right, that we have the opportunity to live with teachers, that I had the opportunity to live with my teacher and see him virtually every day and go into Doksan essentially every week, and then during Sesshin, virtually every day. I remember a student coming into me once and kind of bemoaning the fact, or pining, let me say, over the fact that I was able to be here and study with my teacher all the time and do Doksan and train in this way, and he wasn't, because he was a lay practitioner. And I said, that's true. I said, but when I come home, I don't have two daughters that run up and say, Daddy! I don't have that. You do. And so the Buddha treasure, in a sense, becomes very tangible. And that's why in Buddhism, our teachers, you know, as important and sort of revered as the Buddha Shakyamuni is, and as incalculable is our gratitude and our debt to the Buddha, that it's our living teachers that we can express on an ongoing basis our gratitude to, because they're actually the ones who are allowing this to actually be possible. None of us would be here without Dada Roshis, having come in here and against great odds, I might say, having established this place. And in the midst of great doubts that he would succeed by many. And he would not have come here without his teacher. And so our debt goes back and back and back. But living here and training in this way, and those of you who are in residence have this opportunity to train in this way while you're here. Now, of course, there are some significant differences, you know, so that if you're here for a period of time, a month, a week, weeks, months, a year, 2 years, that, you know, hopefully you are wholeheartedly entering into and really being here in that very singular way. And at the same time, you know that at some point your life beckons to you elsewhere. And that necessarily sits in you, right? That will visit you in terms of calling to you and to prepare or know what that's going to be and contemplate, you know, how you're going to move into the rest of your life. For the monastic, that is not, that has been settled. The future is hopefully a succession of days of waking up in this place, to this Sangha, to this practice, to this training, to this gift. And so that creates a stability. And in that, the Buddha treasure has the opportunity, the seed of that Buddha treasure, of the Buddha nature, has the opportunity to grow in a very strong way, because we're being supported by virtually everything that Buddhism has to offer, essentially. And with a minimum of things that we could use as distractions, or that would seem to be competing or contesting for that seed to develop. Because everything that we are in the midst of is there for that seed to develop. Every interaction, every conversation, every activity, every task performed, no matter how small or large, every conflict, every challenge, every struggle, and that in the midst of all of the fluctuations that must happen, because all is impermanent, and because when we enter into training, our life is just an ongoing series of fluctuations, there's not a lot of stability, because our mind is not stable. Our emotions, our physicality, our energy, our view, there's very little stability in that. And when that, which is universal, is combined with an ongoing flux of what's around us, then it's a little harder to develop true stability. So within the regularity of this life, right, and the lifeblood of spiritual practice, of the monastic life, is the regularity. And from within, you know, modern culture, sort of popular, commercial, consumer culture, the emphasis is always on something new, something different, because that will hopefully, from the perspective of consumer culture, lead you to buy something new and different. And so without that, with the regularity sort of in so many different ways, then those internal fluctuations become very large. There's very little competing with them. And that can be very challenging, right? Because there's, as Pema Chodron taught, that is the wisdom of no escape. There is nowhere to go, right? There is nothing really that we can distract ourselves with other than our mind. And so that gives us the opportunity over time to develop a tremendous and authentic stability. You know, when I think about all of the fluctuations and the moods and the different landscapes, right, of apathy and indifference and listlessness and doubt and insecurity and, you know, just funkiness, general malaise, and yet every day having to show up, having to come in here and sit, whether I wanted to or not, whether I liked it or not, whether I thought it was going to help me or not, and to live with you, whether I wanted to or not. And the you of every day going back to the beginning of my time here. And needing to engage, needing to show up and respond, needing to take care of things, needing to have conversations, needing to meet my teacher and say yes when I wanted to say no. No, I don't want to do that. No, I don't want to get out of bed. No, I don't want to have this conversation. And yet being called to step forward and having to find my own internal peace with that, right? Because I recognized early on, if I just, you know, shove it down and hold on to my not wanting, hold on to my no, then I will make myself miserable, I will make you miserable, and I will learn nothing. I will be wasting my time. And so I realized that I cannot do that. And so how do I find my way into yes when I'm feeling no? How do I find my way into engaging when I want to disengage? And so that steadiness, that regularity, that ongoingness of it, which sometimes itself was seemed like the weight, the burden. But it wouldn't go away. And so so we have to keep finding our way in, finding our way in. And that's why it's so important in monastic discernment, in reflection on coming here, why commitment is so important, because we trust underneath whatever's on the surface and all of the trials and tumult and, you know, the desires and the rationalizations, all of the habits that are screaming to be, you know, continued, all of the desires that are demanding to be fed, that underneath that we know on some level that there is something more important, something larger, something real. And in that the beginning, the inklings, the beginning of the possibility to imagine, to conceive, which can lead to begin to develop in trust in the possibility that could I possibly actually be a Buddha? Do I actually possess the enlightened mind? My teacher says so. The teachings say so all the way back. Could that actually be true? If the Dharma treasure, the teachings being met by them continually in every time we open our mouths and chant a sutra, the verse of the Kesa, the four immeasurables, the four vows, the Heart Sutra, we're continually being met and meeting the Dharma. These profound teachings, which we do not understand. In the beginning, we do not understand these teachings. How could we? And yet, they can call to us. There are aspects, there are glimmers of understanding. There are possibilities of understanding. It's clear that other people understand. Our teachers understand. The teachers going back understand. They speak of something. They speak from a place. They speak of a knowing, of a recognition, of a vision, of an experience of the same world that we're in. And that begins to seep in as a possibility. Now we might say, of course, in the beginning, we all have some faith, some trust that that's true, that I possess Buddha nature, that I can encounter this Dharma, of course. Because otherwise, if we absolutely didn't believe that, we wouldn't walk in the door. But to really begin to have the sense of that possibility as true. You know, I remember so many times listening to my teacher sitting on this seat speaking and having the distinct sense that I was in a world and he was in a world and they weren't the same world. And I thought, how can that be? And I thought, you know, is he actually seeing everything different? Sort of like the Matrix, you know, is it all just ones and zeros? And he's like, you know, having some psychedelic or some Dharma, you know. I was trying to imagine, like, what is going on? But then I would encounter ordinary mind. It's just this. And that encounter with the Dharma, with the teachings that we're meeting every day. And that's so, so important. We have to encounter these teachings over and over and over again. And to every time try to meet them again for the first time. Literally, actually. And by that I mean that we are actually experiencing them. We're engaging them deeply as we can. Which is a very profound practice with something that has become so familiar. That's how the regularity, the ongoing, the continuity, the sameness continues to be alive and fresh and new and powerful. When that is not happening, this becomes a kind of like a house of death, a house of solidification, of calcification, of dullness. And when that happens, we really should just quit. Pack it up. Or come back to life again, which is much easier. We should not, though, be here and presume or maintain that we are practicing Buddha Dharma and not be doing our utmost to actually be doing that. It's not fair. It's not fair to ourselves. It's not fair to anybody who comes here. I remember I've had experiences of being in other monasteries and just being there as a guest, not knowing. But going in and some, not all Buddhists, Christian monasteries, and sometimes wondering, is this alive? And so how that flows into the practice, right? Because of the day-to-dayness and the practice for the monastic, this is it. This is what you have. This is what I have. Right? These teachings, these practices. I remember in moments where of doubt and insecurity and thinking, why am I kidding myself? I can't do this. And thinking, where am I going to go? Where is that next place? What is that next thing? And I had no confidence in that. I had no confidence that for me, there was a next place or a next thing or another teaching or another tradition. I just didn't believe that anymore, which was profoundly helpful. Because when I came back to that again, I realized, just shut up. Just come back. Do what you must do. And free yourself of this mind that doesn't even believe in that other realm, but plays with it. And so how that flows into the practice, how it empowers the practice of meditation, of liturgy, right? I mean, it was so important for me to feel my own teacher's confidence that he was speaking about these practices that I was doing, but in a way that I didn't know. And I realized, you are experiencing this in a way, and I want to. I want to have an experience. I want to know these practices. From the very beginning, I don't know why, but I just had faith in meditation. And that didn't make it was easy. It didn't mean it was easy. It wasn't easy. I mean, I was just stubborn and distracted, and as anybody else. But for some reason, when I encountered it and I began sitting, I just knew this is my path. This is something that I trust. But I knew that also it was, my meditation. Although I believed in it and I felt like it was real and that I was trying my best and it was valid, I also knew that it wasn't wholly in accord with how these masters, these teachers coming down through the ages that I would study, spoke of it. And so it's when that commitment has been made, right? So as monastics, we make these vows and say, yes, this is the life I'm going to live. These are the people I'm going to live it with. This is the path I'm going to live it by. I'm staking my life on this. Then you have to go in. That's the point of that discernment, is to gain that degree of confidence, of trust within oneself. And the degree to which individuals have to know, have to travel, experiment, get around, try different things, that's up to the individual. And of course, I don't think anybody is ordained with that, you know, with an absolute certainty. I wasn't. But what I felt fairly certain about was there is nowhere else to go. If I can't make this work, then I'll just have to do the best I can with something else. And that's pretty much how I felt. I'll just have to do the best I can. And this has nothing to do with the validity or the depth or the possibility of the Buddha Dharma being everywhere in of a person's life, in a lay life, having a brilliant and shining and deep life. I'm talking about me, my experience. And so for lay students, my wish for you is that you feel that way about your life. That whatever you're engaging in, even if it's in transition, because transition is just living today, while in our minds we're in the sense of moving between something and something else. It's a kind of bardo, but we may never get there. That next thing may never happen. We don't know. What we do know is here. And so my wish would be that wherever you find yourself, that you are all in. And the Sangha treasure, to live within a community, and that's just a word, right? Sangha is a word. It's referring to something that is alive and dynamic and complicated and also very simple. Do no harm. Practice good. Care. Care. Know that it matters. Know that your life matters. That's what I wanted. I wanted my life to matter. And that didn't mean, you know, having some big position or being some important person. That wasn't the way I was thinking at all. I never thought of things myself that way. It meant that it mattered to me. That at the end of my life and all along the way, I would feel like I am not wasting my life. That I am using my life well, which meant using everything that I had to offer, because I wanted to be engaging in it, right? I didn't want to just be like sitting around sipping, you know, tea. I wanted to be engaging in something, but that something I wanted to believe mattered. And all the things I was pursuing are valuable when I was studying mathematics, when I was studying music. They're valued, they're needed. But the question was, but do I need to be doing those things? They have value. We need music, like air. But is that what I need to be doing in this life? That's what I meant by something that mattered. Is this what I need to be doing? And so Sangha is how do we actually live and realize and fulfill the Bodhisattva vow? Because we can't do it philosophically, intellectually, abstractly, right? So we can, you know, practice it alone or in isolation or live in a hut somewhere and think, I love everyone, right? I want everyone to be happy. But is that actually true? And so we have to actually show ourselves, demonstrate to ourselves and the world, for crying out loud, that we can do that, that we can actually love deeply. And not because of your story or your personality or what you're doing for me, but just because you. That great heart that has no tether, that has no precondition. I couldn't even imagine that kind of presence within me. And perhaps I'm not alone, because think about why the Dharma for so many hundreds of years have used certain examples, like of a parent and a child, sort of universal examples of what might it be like to care that deeply, that selflessly, and then to extend that to everyone, right? Is it because it's hard for all of us that those teachings have been taught every generation and been passed down? So that we can begin to imagine or struggle to imagine that as a possibility, and not just in the world abstractly for some highly realized person, but for you, for me. And so it's in the everyday, the continual sort of saturation and of encountering these teachings and these invocations where you yourself are invoking. You're the one who is wishing that all beings be free of suffering. You are the one who is wishing that every being be happy. You're the one who is delighting in the good qualities of others. To whatever degree you can. Because that's enough now in the practice when you're doing it right now. And then as you come back to that, and as you come back to that, and as you come back to that, it will grow. Because that's how we work, that's how karma works, that's how practice works. And so the things that we got so hung up in, personalities and temperaments and styles and looks and all of those things, as time goes on, it's not so much that they don't matter, but they don't matter in the old way. They don't matter as points of contention, as points of difference. They matter because they become connected to you. And when that love is extended to you, that person, this person, then those qualities become part of that love, of that compassion. Why I feel like monasteries are so important and monastics are so important is that there be places for those few who will want to dedicate their lives to this life. And that there be places where those who are going to wholeheartedly engage their lives as practitioners in their world can come and come together and learn from each other and be inspired and in turn be inspiring, because they go together. And has there ever been a time when that has been more in demand? Where every person, any person who is thinking about today, who is concerned about tomorrow, who is concerned for each other, who wants whatever they're doing in this life for that to matter, who is committed to not wasting this life and to exploring what does it mean not to waste this life? And what does that mean for you? That's what we need in this world. Samsara presents itself as an easy path. That's its seduction. And spiritual practice, particularly as we train, can seem very difficult. And it is. But what's difficult is not the path. It's our mind. It's our uncertainty and doubt. And so, I'm so grateful that this has come down to us and that we have had this great fortune and that we have this wonderful, what is a group of monastics called? We'll have to come up with something appropriate. A gathering for now, that we have such a wonderful group of monastics who madly have decided to make this their lives or are in discernment. And that there are all of you who insanely want to put yourself here and engage this despite the odds, in the midst of all the doubts, yours and others, because evidently you care that much about your life. May that flame never dim.
Thank you for listening. To find out more about ZMM's programs, retreats, and residency, please visit us online at zmm.org.